Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education.
Let's say you're the manager of a factory racing to fill orders on a deadline a week away. If this morning you offered your workers a cash reward for exceeding today's quota, sure enough, most of them would probably qualify for the bonus by the end of the day. A win-win, right? It is until tomorrow when the bonus deal has expired, because that's when your workers slack off, even from their usual pace, because there is no special deal. From KERA in Dallas, this is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. It turns out that much of what we believe we know intuitively about persuading people, including ourselves, to do things is a lot more complicated than we think. Before a person will work really hard at something, it helps if it means something. Dan Ariely joins us to talk about his research into all of this. He's James P. Duke Professor of Psychology and Behavioral Economics at Duke University. His new book is called Payoff, The Hidden Logic That Shapes Our Motivations. And he joins us from the studios of WUNC in Durham, North Carolina. Dan, welcome to Think.
My pleasure. Nice to be here.
Motivation is paradoxical. We feel as if we understand exactly why we do what we do, but it doesn't necessarily work the way we believe it does. Why do we oversimplify how motivation works?
So I'm not sure we oversimplify or we overthink. I'm not sure which one it is, but we certainly get it wrong. And a part of it is what is called the inside and outside perspective. So when you're in something, the forces that work on you are very, very different. So imagine that you're running. When you're at the moment of running, you know, not the first minute maybe, but kind of 10 minutes into it, there's different forces that determine what makes you happy and not happy, what kind of stride you're able to find out and so on. When you're thinking about running in advance, you don't truly understand the forces that control you while you're in that process. And because of that, you get things wrong. That's one principle. Another thing we get wrong is the pleasure principle. Think about what is the general thought? What are we striving for? We have this idea that we have the right to pursue happiness. What kind of happiness is it? What do we mean when we say happiness? And usually, when we think about happiness, we say, oh, it's about sitting on the beach drinking mojito or sitting in front of the TV watching some sitcom. That's kind of the momentary happiness that we have. And it's true, it's momentary happiness, but how many of us would want a lifetime of those things? On the other hand, think about something like a marathon. If you came from out of space and you looked at people who run a marathon, you would say, what did these people do that they got this punishment? Like who?
Right.
Who, like, you know,
who in their right mind would do this? Right.
That's right. They must have paying for some sin. And it's true that when you look at people who run the marathon, you took brain images, you look at their facial expression and so on, at no point will they seem like they're having fun. They don't burst out laughing all of a sudden in the middle. But nevertheless, those things give them a deep sense of happiness and satisfaction. But it's not from the momentary sense of happiness. And lots of things in life are like this. When you say to yourself, writing a book, running a marathon, starting a company, having kids, most of those things are not moments of pure joy. But they give us a very different sense of understanding of ourselves, of other people, of our accomplishment, and so on. And when we think about the right to pursue happiness, I think we will be better off if we thought about the second type, but we often think about the first type. And then there are other reasons for this mistake as well. But the main point is that when we think about what drives our behavior and what makes us happy, we don't truly understand that. We need kind of somebody else to look at our lives, hopefully science, and to tell us what actually drives us and what actually makes us happy, because at the moment, we don't always make the right decisions.
You were asked a few years ago to meet with a family that had just suffered this really horrible tragedy, and you wanted to help, but you knew that showing up just to offer the comfort of your presence would come at a real emotional cost to you. Will you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, so this is actually, you know, that particular story was a particularly tough one, but things like that happen to me on a weekly basis. So I wrote my first book almost 9 years ago, And I wrote very clearly about my own injury and my own life in the burn department. And after writing so openly about my own life in hospital, I get lots of people with injuries that write me, and they want to talk about life after the injury. And in this particular case, it wasn't the person who was injured that wrote me. It was a friend of the mother of two kids who got injured. And she actually called me up, and she said, there was a terrible accident. Would you mind showing up in the hospital, in the burn department? So I stopped. I was in the middle of dinner with some friends. I left. I went to the hospital. And I learned that there was a tragic accident when two young kids got badly burned. And I myself was burned many years before that, and I was in the burn department for about 3 years. I got burned in about 70% of my body. And these kids were burned slightly worse, not, you know, worse than I did. Not, and not in terms of a percentage, but in terms of the depth of their burns.
Mm-hmm.
And anyway, the mother asked me all kinds of questions that were difficult. She asked me, what would the kids want to know in this state of being in and out of consciousness and with all of this machinery and beeps and sounds and so on? And I, you know, there's no scientific answer to this, but I tried to kind of go back to my own days in the burn department. And I told her that a lot of it was about understanding what was going on. The environment is so painful and confusing, and the drugs, of course, create extra confusion. And knowing what the different sounds are and what symbols something good, like you never know when beeps are good or when beeps are bad from these machines. So to kind of try to help the kids understand that. And I spent a few hours with them, and then I left. And about 2 days later, I get a call from the mother, and a very kind of quick and crying voice. She said, "Please come over." And she hangs up, and I show up in the burn department, and I learned that one of the kids passed away. And she asked me whether to tell the other kid. And, you know, again, there's no answer to this question. It's not something that, you know, we know what's the right thing to do. But again, I was trying to think about my own days in the burn department and what was my capacity to even comprehend and grief and think and so on. And I asked her not to. I said, look, it's impossible for anybody to deal with any gravity. You're kind of so consumed with the pain and the fear and so on. I don't even know how you grieve with being with breathing equipment and all of this. And I just thought she should hide it from the other kid for as long as possible. And then 3 months later, I get another email from her this time, and she said her kid who survived is doing better, and she wants me to send him a letter, kind of being optimistic about his future. And that was really, really tough for me, because I didn't know how to be optimistic. He was very badly burned. He lost most of his fingers, eyebrows, hair, will have a very hard time opening his mouth. I mean, lots of things were very, very tough. And I also knew that, you know, I had a 3-year recovery period, but even though now it's many years after that, I still had surgery last year. So I knew it was going to be a very long, painful process, and that neither he nor she understand what a long via dolorosa this was going to be. And I didn't want to lie. I didn't want to be not optimistic, and I really didn't know what to do. And I cried a lot, and I thought about it for about 2 days. And at the end of it, I kind of wrote in something that was real but slightly optimistic. So I told him that life is going to be very different, and life is never going to be normal for him. That's not in the cards. I told him that he has many, many years of recovery, and that it will not be simple, and he needs to prepare for that. But I also told him that technology is on the side of the disabled, that it used to be that people had kind of standard jobs. Everyone needed to do the same thing. But with technology, they give extra advantage to people with disabilities. We can figure out exactly what kind of things we can do well and not, and we can kind of focus on the things we do well and not do the things we're not suited to. And my own career as a professor is very much like that, where I love what I do, but being a professor is a very flexible profession. I can work more when I feel better. I can work less when I don't feel as well. I don't need to use my hands that much because I can't move them much. So there's all kinds of advantages from that. And I finished writing, and I didn't type this. I recorded this because I don't, my fingers don't work very well. So I recorded him a voice message, and I send with email this voice file. And a few hours later, I get another email from the mother and said, oh, how much the kid enjoyed it, and can I send another one? And the last chapter of this, actually, it's not the last chapter, but the last chapter I'll tell you about is that I went to visit him a few months later in the hospital. And I didn't know how it would be, and I was kind of worried, but when I got there, things were really wonderful. We talked, and I told him about all kinds of things about my own life, and he kind of shared a little bit about life in hospital and so on, and it was wonderful. Kind of, we felt very close to each other, I think, in both ways. And then at some point, the nurse came, and she said that he was going to have a new type of treatment. And he said, can he do it tomorrow? And she said, no. He said, can he do it in a few hours? She said, no. He said, can I do it in an hour? She said, no. He said, can I do it on one part of the body? She said, no. He said, can I do it just to start with on one part of the body? And she said, no.
And no control. Point,
no control. And at that point, I could no longer stand. I was standing next to him when he was negotiating with her. And I remembered all my negotiations with the nurses. And I basically kind of almost collapsed. I had to sit down. I put my head between my legs, and I was trying to breathe. And then when she left the room, I quickly said goodbye and left. And it reminded me about all kind of the helplessness of being in hospital. And, I keep on talking to him from time to time. But the two lessons from this for me were, the first one was that I did not realize until that moment what a big part of my misery had to do with learned helplessness. You could easily think about the pain and about the misery and about the many years in hospital and being in bed and physical challenges and so on. But the helplessness part was not something I thought so clearly about as something that dictated my misery during my time in hospital and some after that. But the second thing is, this whole experience, and I do things in that vein on a weekly basis, was clearly miserable. There was no moments of joy, elation, laughing, and so on. But I was drawn to help. And it wasn't as if I have like an S&M tendency, right, that I enjoy misery or I want more pain. I have enough of it. But it made clear to me that maybe there's kind of two types of happiness. And there's the easy one of laughing and drinking and, doing things that are kind of pleasurable at the moments, but maybe the more important ones are the things that give us satisfaction, the things we help other people and feel meaning and connection and so on, and they don't come with the regular happiness. It's a very, very different type of happiness.
My guest is Dan Ariely. He's James P. Duke Professor of Psychology and Behavioral Economics at Duke University, and he's author of the new book, Payoff, The Hidden Logic That Shapes Our Motivations. We'll resume our conversation with Dan in a few minutes. If you'd like to join us, you can call 1-800-933-5372.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education. Fall registration is now open with courses in art, architecture, history, and languages, as well as professional certificates and test preparation. Registration at smu.edu/CAPE.
This is Think. I'm Chris Boyd, speaking this hour with Dan Ariely, who is James P. Duke Professor of Psychology and Behavioral Economics at Duke University and author of Payoff, The Hidden Logic That Shapes Our Motivations. If you'd like to join the conversation, you can email think@kera.org, or you can find us on Twitter at kera.org. Dan, you write about a number of experiments on motivation in this book. And, you know, with the background of that story that you just told us, first of all, I want to ask you, when you realized that the trauma that you went through, that you didn't ask for, that you wouldn't wish on anybody, no matter what kind of growth you experienced, when you realized that that was, in fact, a driving force, not only in the condition of your health, but in the way you were motivated and the way you saw the world?
So quite early on in many ways. So there are a few things early on in the burn department that really bothered me, like the way that the nurses removed the bandages from burn patients. And actually the nurses believe that the right way to remove bandages from burn patients is to rip them off quickly, to minimize the duration, even if every second is very painful. And I didn't believe them. I mean, you know, I as somebody who was on the other side of the bandages, I felt very differently about it. And when I started studying at the university, I started experimenting on this. Some of my first experiments were about this idea of how to deliver pain over time, and I showed that they were wrong. Another thing that happened was that placebos. At that time, there was the belief that if they gave a lot of morphine to patients, we will become addicted. So we had a budget of how much morphine we could get, and it was one of the only decisions that we could do is to space out the morphine. So we had 6 dosages a day, and we could decide when we want the next one. And from time to time, I'm kind of an obsessive guy, so I would, of course, track my own dosage and kind of make decisions all the time about can I hold a little bit more, can I take the next one, and so on. And I really wanted to keep some for the night so I could sleep a little bit. But I would not only track my own morphine, I would track other people's morphine as well.
Scientist even and, as a teenager.
Scientist is a nice way to do it. Obsessive or, you know, competitive is another one. But from time to time, I would hear one of the other patients cry, and the nurse would go to their room and give them something, and they would fall asleep. And I knew it was too much. And I would call the nurse and I say, hey, I think Ronnie or whoever it was got too much extra morphine. Can I get some as well? And they told me that she just gave him morphine, placebo. She just gave him IV fluid with nothing in it. And, you know, it's an amazing thing to read about placebos and to say, hey, we can give people injections with nothing and they feel pain relief. But when you know how much pain the person in the room next to you is experiencing, and you realize that they got nothing and nevertheless they were able to fall asleep, that's an amazing thing. And I've also started doing research on placebos. So, and then there were some really strange things. Like I remember, so I was in bed for many years, right? For a long time I was in bed. And there were a few kind of things of getting out of hospital that were odd. Like the first time I had to eat. So for months I had a little tube through my nose that would feed me. And they would feed me with 30 eggs a day and 7,000 calories a day. And this was to kind of help the body rebuild some of the lost tissue. And I remember when they took out this tube and they asked me to eat myself, it felt so strange to chew. Like the whole chewing thing felt like, you know, it's so vulgar and primitive, like, you know, what the cleanliness. I got used to it. And then I remember another thing is that when I first time I went home and had the bath at home, I slowly lowered myself into the bath. I was sitting in the hot water for a while, you know, and so on. And then I had to get out of the bath, and I had no memory. Like, how do you get out of a bath? What do you do first? Like, you put your legs, you put your hands. What exactly do you do? You know, it is so easy to forget all kinds of things that we do and for them to become non-natural. And the metaphor for this, of course, was much broader, because after 3 years in bed, looking at life but not being part of it, a lot of things that people were doing seem strange. I was 18 and looking at my friends courting and dating and having a social life and deciding how to spend their time. A lot of it looked very strange from the side, because when you're not in the system for a while, a lot of the things you look a little bit like as an alien.
Yeah.
And I think it's actually been a perspective. I still feel a little bit like this. You know, every time I go to a public space, it's very clear that I'm, you know, burned and I have scars. And if people look at me and they try to shake my hand is very different. And when people shake it, it reminds me how differently they see me, because some people shake it all kinds of ways. But the point is that being an outsider is not such a regular, fun way to live, but for a social scientist, I think it's a very effective way to look at things a little bit more objectively and also get ideas for maybe why we act the way we act.
What is the IKEA effect?
So, do you have any IKEA furniture?
Yes, actually I do.
Yes, okay. So I remember building an IKEA chest of drawers for my kids' toys. And we basically, me and that piece of IKEA furniture, got to spend an afternoon together. and you know, it took longer than I expected. It was a prolonged experience. The instructions were terrible, or maybe I'm just terrible at this, but I would put the wrong pieces in the right place. I would get things in the wrong direction. I would have to unassemble. It was a frustrating experience, but when we finished that afternoon and I put that piece on the side in the room and we put the toys in that, I felt a pride that was unmatched by buying the same piece of furniture from somebody else. And since then, we moved 4 times and I kept on taking this chest of drawer with us, even though, you know, the objective quality of that piece of mediocre furniture.
$179, right?
That's right. It's not worth the probably the transportation cost. But we're connected in a very different way. And like many things that social scientists do, is you first observe some odd behavior on your own part, and then you ask yourself, am I the only person who is strange? Is this something more general? And let's look at it. And we decided to look at it initially with origami. So we wanted something that people could build, that could be built in different levels of quality, and it wouldn't take forever. So we got people to build origami, and people built an origami. And then we said to them, look, you worked for us. You came to the lab, you worked, you built origami, but we paid you by the hour, so officially the origami is ours. But if you want, we'll give you a chance to buy it from us. How much would you buy it for? And then we took another group who didn't build that origami. And we say, hey, you didn't build this origami, but there's this origami that somebody else built. How much would you pay for it? And what we saw was that the people who built the origami thought it was great. The people who didn't build origami thought it was not so great. But then we said another question. We said, look, could it be that when we build an origami, we love it, but we recognize that the people who did not build it would not look at it our way? Or is it the case that we love it and we think that everybody would see it our way? So we asked the builders to predict how much money non-builders would spend on these origami, and they were basically trapped in their own perspective. Hmm. The builders, the people who build origami, thought that everybody would love their origami as much as they did. And then we did something more extreme. We said, look, one of the magic pieces of the IKEA instructions was that it was so difficult to follow. What happens if we made instructions for origami that were more difficult to follow? And what we saw was that the origami was just uglier, right? I mean, people, it was just less attractive. But what happened to the people who built it? Did they see it as less attractive? No, they saw it as more attractive. Why? Because they spent more time with it. They struggled with it more. It had more of themselves. And what happened to the people who didn't build it? They hate it. They liked it even less, right? So what happened is that when we invest more for ourselves into something, we love it even more, but the people who are not connected to it, they're not trapped to our own perspective, and they evaluate in a more objective way. And there's kind of two lessons here. I think the first one is that we don't invest enough in things. Like, if you think about the regular approach for life, is you say, oh, you know, we need to make dinner, and if somebody else could make it for us, that's great. We need to, you know, plant the garden. If somebody else can do it for us, that's great. And, you know, maybe it is great at the moment because you don't have to struggle with it, but we kind of give up some of the love that we could have to things. And if we just had understood this principle a bit more, maybe we would invest more in things, and over time we would also get more out of them, right? If we plant our own garden, yes, we will invest more in it up front, but we will get a stream of happiness down the line that will come from our love for it. And then the second thing is we need to recognize that when we build something or when we have an idea or something, we're kind of trapped in our own perspective, that the love we have for it might not be shared by other people. And that has all kinds of ramification. It has ramification in terms of people falling in love with their ideas. It has ramification in terms of people falling in love with their homes and when they try to sell them, and so on. So like many other behavioral economics phenomena, it has good things and has some challenges or some traps.
You're listening to Think. I'm Chris Boyd. Dan Ariely, when I read that, I read about the IKEA effect and I read about the origami. As a parent, I was thinking about raising kids. And it sounds to me, I'm guessing there's no research into this at all, but parents not only, you know, love their kids and go through a lot of, you know, heartaches that would seem really unappealing to people who don't have or want children. And there's also this weird fear that we have as parents, especially when our kids are small, that they will be taken away from us, right, by some bad kidnapping stranger. Statistically, it's horrific, but it's incredibly rare. But it's like every parent's deepest kind of constant fear. And I wonder if that has anything to do with these effects that you're talking about.
Yeah, so I've done this research a lot informally, but here is how it goes. So I usually do it when I'm in front of an audience, and I ask people. I said, look, imagine somebody came to you, and they say, look, I met your kids in the park. We played for 2 hours. They looked like wonderful kids. How much would you sell them to me? and they say, look, I promise they'll have a good life and so on, but I will take them away from you. You'll have no more memories and experiences and so on with these kids from now forward. How much would you sell them for? And, you know, sometimes the people who respond have teenagers, but mostly they say, I'm not willing to sell my kids for any amount in the world. They are what makes my life happy and meaningful and so on, and I can't really describe the pleasure that they give me. And then you say, okay, let's think about another perspective. Imagine you don't have kids and you go to the park and you meet two kids and you play with them for 2 hours and, you know, they seem like nice. They're just like the kids you have right now. They're basically very, very similar to that. And as you're about to leave, the parents of these kids say, hey, by the way, before you leave, if you're interested, they're for sale. And you say, how much would you pay for them? Right? And the same people who said that there would be no amount of money that could separate them from their kids are saying, if they were not my kids, I don't think I'll pay anything for them. And the realization, of course, is that we love our kids, and a lot of it is because they're ours, right? If they were just our kids, but they were somebody else's, it wouldn't be the same. And it is like the kids are like the ultimate IKEA furniture in the sense that the instructions are difficult to follow. We don't exactly know what to do. We stumble, we make mistakes and so on. But it's this process of difficulty and challenges and complexity that creates this tremendous amount of love. And again, like the example we gave with the garden or with food and so on, if we take away all of those effortful parts of life and raising kids and so on, we also don't develop the same level of deep love that we would have for our kids.
All right, let's go to the phones now at 1-800-933-5372. Hannah is calling from Arlington. Hello, Hannah.
Hello, how are you?
Very well, thanks.
So my question is, you were talking earlier about these two types of happiness that you felt between the laughing and good times type and then this deeper feeling of satisfaction. So my question is, do you believe that one of these is more impactful and valuable, meaningful, and worth pursuing than the other?
So Yes, I do. I think we need a bit of both, but there's a way to think about life, which is to say, what would cause you regret? So you could say, when you're on your deathbed, when you look back at your life, what would give you a sense that this was a worthwhile life? And if you don't want to go all the way there, and you can say, let's look at the last decade or the last year or even the last month. But let's think about a longer perspective than about a day-by-day perspective. And when you think about long perspective, I think the things that would make us happy are the second type, are the type that has to do with meaning and accomplishment and overcoming challenges, things like marathons and running companies and writing books and so on, not things that are about the daily joy. And, you know, from time to time, it's good to, you know, sit on the beach and get drunk. But we don't want a life of it. So it's certainly, you want a mix. But I think that you want the majority of the happiness that you derive to be of the second type, to be of the type that is the meaningful type.
Is there a reason why, you know, things that are hard to do, there's such a barrier to entry, right? We avoid them even though we sense that they might make us happy in the long run.
Yeah, and again, it's because the same thing, right? So if let's just take an example of writing a book, right? If writing a book was a task that made people giggle as they were doing it, there would be no problem. People would just go into it. But the daily joy is low. So what do? We opt for the daily joy things, and by doing so, we take away from our ability to experience the long-term, meaningful joy.
We're speaking this hour with Dan Ariely of Duke University. He's professor of psychology and behavioral economics there. He's got a new book out called Payoff, The Hidden Logic That Shapes Our Motivations. We'll resume the conversation in a couple of minutes. You can join it by calling 1-800-933-5372 or find us on Twitter at KERAThink.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education. Fall registration is now open with courses in art, architecture, history, and languages, as well as professional certificates and test preparation. Registration at smu.edu/CAPE.
This is Think. I'm Chris Boyd, speaking this hour with Dan Ariely, who is James P. Duke Professor of Psychology and Behavioral Economics at Duke University. His new book is called Payoff, The Hidden Logic That Shapes Our Motivations. Dan, you have learned some really interesting things about the way that money does or does not motivate us. I mean, most of us, to a certain extent, have our jobs because we need the money, right? We need to support ourselves. Most people are not independently wealthy, but there are sort of degrees of being in it just to get cash as opposed to feeling like the work has deep meaning. When people just say that they work for the money or even believe that they're in it for the money, is it the money or is it like the social status that they believe is attached to that money or is it the security that is attached to that money?
Yeah, so money provides lots of things, right? So money is money, which means we can buy food and shelter and pay for health insurance. Money is a yardstick to measure ourselves against. It's something that we try to maximize and think about. It's something that gets us to focus on it. But the question is, if you thought about kind of the motivation equation, if you say M equals, motivation equals all kinds of things, what will be all of those things in that motivation equation and how much of it will be money? And of course, you know, it's good to get paid and it's good to be able to pay for all kinds of things. But when we think about paying people, there's a way to pay the same amount in different ways, right? So, for example, I could pay you X amount of money per year. I could say pay you 95% of X per year and put 5% as a bonus that you might get. I could pay you 20% of this X per year and make 80% of it into a bonus. I could make some of it is in a very clear bonus about what you need to do. I could make it some of it in a very unclear bonus. So even if we talk about the same amount of money, there are ways to distribute that money that make a difference. And one of the things we don't understand is how much effort we have taken to make work not just about money. And the reason for that is goodwill. So think about your own work and think about it and say to yourself, how many hours a week do you work now? And what is the amount of hours a week that you could get away with? If you just wanted to work the least amount possible and still not get fired, what is the minimum amount of work that you could get away with? And when I ask lots of people say, you know, we really work way, way too much. If we only wanted to make sure that we don't get fired, we would work much less hours. But the reason we worked it is we care about work. And now the question is, okay, so if people care about work, and as we move to the knowledge economy, how much people care about work and how much goodwill is involved is becoming more and more important, how is the way we pay people influencing goodwill? And here's the experiment to make it concrete, which you alluded to in the beginning of the program. So this was an experiment with Intel, the chip manufacturer. And in this experiment, it's in a factory where people come for 4 days on and 4 days off. When on the days that they're on, they have very long shifts, 12-hour shifts, and then they have 4 days off. And what Intel has been doing is to say, look, when you come off the 4 days off, we want the first day to be kind of full on. So we'll ask you to try and produce lots of chips, lots of computer chips, let's say 1,300. And if you reach that target, we'll give you a bonus of $30. And if you don't reach that target, you'll get zero. Okay. And then the second day, there's no bonus. The third day, there's no bonus. The fourth day, there's no bonus. 4 days off, back to the first day with the target and the bonus. So we asked them to add all kinds of things to that experiment. We said, what if we had a control condition? What if we had a condition in which we didn't offer people anything? We just compared it to nothing, and we saw how much this thing helps. And they said, okay. And then we said, what if we had another condition in which we offered people pizza? So we had the same target, 1,300 chips, and we said, if you make it, we'll send you pizza at home that night. It turned out that was too complex for the HR department at Intel, but they agreed to give people a voucher for pizza, which is not the same as pizza, but still, that's what they agreed. But then they agreed to a fourth condition in which we gave people a compliment. So here's what happened. People came on that day, let's call it a Monday. A quarter of the people were told nothing. A quarter of the people were told, if you reach 1,300 chips, you'll get $30. A quarter of the people told, if you reach 1,300 chips, you'll get a voucher for pizza. And a quarter of the people were told, if you reach 1,300 chips, you'll get a nice text message from the boss saying nice job. Another question is, how much do they work? And it turned out that the three conditions, money, pizza, and text, worked harder than the control condition. Money was slightly worse than the other two, but they were all much better, and money was only slightly better. But the question was also, what happens the next day? Because you see, the moment I pay you, you're under that influence. But the next day was a measurement of goodwill, right? There was no bonus anymore. There was no target. There was no bonus. What happened? The people who got the money on the first day, their performance on the first day went up by about 5%. It went down by 12% the second day. On the second day, they performed worse than a control condition. It's as if those people say, you know what? Yesterday you paid me, I care. Today you're not paying me, I'm not interested. The next day, the performance went up slightly. The fourth day, slightly up again. But in total, by giving people $30 in bonuses, Intel lost 5% of productivity.
Wow.
Now, by the way, 5% for a production factory, it's a lot. It's a lot. People do lots of effort to get 1% improvement. And here, they use their own theory of what motivates people and got people to be less motivated. Now, what happens with the compliment condition? Performance went up on the first day, slightly more than the payment condition, and slowly went down over the next 3 days, but overall creating an absolute improvement. And the voucher for pizza was kind of between the two all along. And this relates to this issue of market norms and social norms. You know, if you think about why do we pay people hourly wages? Why do we pay people yearly wages? Why do we give people social benefits? A lot of the story is that we try to get people to think about work not as work per hour, not as a production per minute. We try to get people to care about the job in general. Imagine in your own profession, they would pay you per word, right? What would it do? I mean, you'll probably speak faster, shorter words. I mean, all kinds of things like that. But a lot of what we do at work is to try and get people to be connected to the mission of the work, to the goal of what they're doing. And the moment you change the focus of attention from thinking about the big picture to thinking about the only thing I want from you is 1,300 chips a day, we basically detract people's overall motivation. By the way, this is what we did in the No Child Left Behind policy when we took teachers and we say, oh, you thought you're here for education and the future of the country and, you know, the next generation and so on. No. All we care about is the performance of these kids in this one test at the end of the year. And you could get $400 more a year if they do a little bit better. And teachers basically said something much like the people at Intel, which is to say, really? That's all you care about? You know what? I'm just not that interested to start with. So what happened is that we think about something like marriage. You know, you think about the overall goals of the couple. We think about the meaning. We think about the relationship. We think about commitment and so on. The moment you take the incentive and you say, I only care about this one piece for one day, you change your focus from long-term to short-term, from the overall goodness of the company to something very specific. And people get less connected to the company. They care less about it. And the motivation is diminished.
No matter how much we love our jobs or our families or our yards that we're taking care of, there are days when we all just have to power through tasks that do not feel rewarding in any way. They're just things we have to do. What have you learned, Dan, about finding meaning in the mundane?
Yeah, so there's lots of ways to do that. And one of them, of course, is that by caring about other people, we can motivate ourselves to do things on the mundane. So, for example, we did some studies a while ago that about exercising, and we found, kind of unsurprisingly, that if you make an appointment to meet a friend, you will show up and then you'll exercise, right? We kind of don't care about ourselves as much, but if you made an appointment to meet somebody, you're going ahead and do it. So if you have a teamwork, you might not feel like doing the thing, but if you care about your team, you will show up for the team because it's the team. That's one approach. Another approach is to think about rituals. So, you know, think about what gets us to do things repeatedly and derive extra meaning from them. So imagine that you wake up every morning and every morning you decide if to recycle or not. If you do it every morning, you would say many mornings, you know what, how much is the city hall saving? How cold is it outside? You'll decide many days not to recycle. But if you say to yourself, I have a rule that I recycle every day, you'll follow that rule much more frequently. And if you'll not only that, but you'll give that rule a meaning, you'll say, you know what, good people recycle. My part of the world is such that I think recycling is important. You'll be even more likely to do it. So there's all kinds of little tricks of how to not get the small details of life to derail us from our long motivation. Because, look, it's amazing. If we just show up and work every day, we'll make a lot of progress. And if we every day just shirk and wait for the muse and wait for to feel productive, it's just not going to work out. So a lot of life is about showing up, even if you don't feel exactly right at that moment, and doing what you promised to do.
This is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. Dan Ariely is my guest. His new book is called Payoff, A Hidden Logic That Shapes Our Motivations. Dan, what can we gain from thinking on a fairly regular basis about our own mortality?
Yes. So, you know, mortality is a really interesting thing, right? If you talk about people who believe in the afterlife or reincarnation and so on, that's a different story. But what is interesting is that even people who believe that when we die, we just die, still care about what will happen after their death. And people do all kinds of funny things with wills. There are people who try to settle scores. There are people who try to make things even. There are people who try to express hate. There was one guy that his wife gave him a really hard time all his life for smoking cigars. So in his will, he basically said that the condition she gets paid every year a sum of money under the condition that on the anniversary of his death, she will smoke a cigar. You know, so people do all kinds of things. But, you know, there was a listener earlier that asked, you know, which one of the two types of happiness is the right one? The one that is momentary and the one that is has a longevity. And I think the fact that we want something from ourselves to remain after we die, the fact that we care about how other people would feel about us after we pass away, the fact that we care about, you know, how have we left this world, suggests that this long-term perspective is much more important.
Do you ever think?
And then the other thing.
Oh, I'm sorry. Go ahead.
And then the other thing is that when we think about the long-term perspective, we actually become slightly better version of ourselves. Right? It's not about what do I feel right now, but what is the big picture? And when we think about the big picture and when we act more in line with the big picture, we are better versions of ourselves.
Do you ever think about your own funeral?
I don't. I don't think about my own funeral. Well, you know, I thought a few times, but not regularly. But I do think about what I want this world to look like after I'm no longer in it. I think about, you know, I do lots of research on poverty. We do lots of research on healthcare. We're trying to get people to exercise, save, take their medications. And, you know, this idea that we're making small steps of progress all the time and that we kind of do things that are research-based, that are influencing policy and so on, gives me tremendous satisfaction. There was recently a law that was signed into effect that I had a hand in helping. And knowing that this law is now on the books gives me tremendous satisfaction.
Dan Ariely is James P. Duke Professor of Psychology and Behavioral Economics at Duke University. His new book is Payoff, The Hidden Logic That Shapes Our Motivations. Dan, I'm so glad we could speak with you again. Thank you so much for joining us.
Same here. Looking forward to next time.
Think is produced by Stephen Becker and engineered by Alan Roberts. Samantha Guzman is associate producer with help on the phones today from Javier Hiribet. And our executive producer is Jeff Whittington. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening. Have a great day.